Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 282. How you doing, guys? Thank you for tuning in. I have a rare return guest this week in Sarah Pascoe. Every now and then, and not that often, I'll say that an episode is one of my all-time favourites. There's actually two or three coming up that come into that category. But when I finished this one, I came out thinking this is possibly my all-time favourite. Not one of, but my all-time favourite conversation I've had on the podcast. Sarah is wonderful. She's intelligent and funny, but also she's open to discussion and debate, and you don't feel attacked in any of that. And it was it felt like a really important conversation. You know, important sounds grand and everything, but yeah, I just really enjoyed this conversation. I was really grateful to have Sarah on. So yeah, she's my, as we mentioned, she's my most requested guest that I've already had on, because I had her on in the early days. In fact, we talk about all this in the intro.
So the reason Sarah has returned now, a couple of things that we talk about in the podcast, but I wanted to mention it in this intro, is she has a new book, Sex, Power, Money, and she's done a companion podcast to go with that. So check that out. We're going to talk about it a load, and you're going to want to, but I just wanted to get it in now.
I'm going to get straight into it. I've got loads to tell you about in the outro, but I'll save that for the outro. We're brought to you as ever by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's where you can buy merch for the podcast, for my label, and for myself. And patreon.com/scroobiuspip. We've just had the poem of the month. Next week is Distraction Pieces Rewind. In fact, it might in fact be the one where we talk about the first time that Sarah Pascoe came on. So, yeah, it's great. I'll chat more at the end. If this is your first time tuning in, we speak about a lot of cool people, but I've had some amazing guests in the past, so including Sarah's first visit. Go back and listen to that if you fancy it. But also people like James A. Acaster, Ashlyn B., Catherine Ryan, Cariad Lloyd, Izzy Sooty, Josie Long. Loads of amazing and wonderful comedians. So, yeah, I want to list more. Nish Kumar, Ed Gamble. I mean, if you want to bring up Stuart Lee and Adam Buxton, then sure, why not? And Richard Herring, let's bring them up. Charlie Brooker, throw him in there, why not? Had some amazing guests. So anyway, on with the podcast. This is episode 282 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the return of Sarah Pascoe. Oh, sorry to interrupt again. One more thing before we get started. We go deep and heavy into some big topics. So obviously, number one, a bit of a trigger warning there. But number two, we're just speaking really honestly and openly. But they're complex subjects. So I want to kind of apologize in advance if any terms or names or phrases used aren't correct. Particularly, for example, I mean, we talk about the sex work industry, and there's a lot of terms and phrases. It's such a developing industry and changing industry at the moment. I know, for example, the word prostitute was once the standard word, and through kind of the bastardization of its use in the media, it's become a less acceptable one. So there's a lot of things like that that are constantly changing. So I just wanted to pop up quickly and say, if we slightly use any slightly incorrect phrases or terms, please take it in the spirit of the conversation, and hopefully you can kind of, yeah, not let it distract you too much from the content of what's being discussed. Anyway, on with the podcast. Bye now. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. It's always that thing on podcasts of not wanting to talk too much until we're rolling.
Because you have to repeat yourself.
Yeah. So I'm joined today by Sarah Pascoe. How are you?
I'm really well, thank you.
This is exciting for me because I'm not sure if I've mentioned this online or not, but you're my most requested guest that I've already had on.
Oh, really?
And I think it's because you were on quite early.
Yes.
And I also think possibly you were the first ever person I forgot to take a Polaroid picture
with. Yeah, I was thinking that on the way here because I was thinking I should put some makeup on. I didn't, listeners, but I did think about it.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, he might forget to take a photo again.
This is the first time it had happened and it destroyed me. But I wonder if that's part of the reason that it's been overlooked. It's weird because recently James Acaster has started to challenge you, but I think he's one that, again, because I had him on early, both of you have done so much since then that it's easy
to... Yeah, and if you've got newer listeners, people do that. I've had a thing recently where a few people have said, you should do Taskmaster, you'd be really good at it. And you have the thing, like, I did season three. Yeah, I did. Yep. And I wasn't good at it. Thank you.
Yeah, it's one of my favourite shows to watch, to talk about. I think it's just consistently... It kind of annoys me because it was around season three or four that I was like, they're going to run out of good tasks at some point. And this year's was the best tasks they've ever had.
I think it's like, they're very good at kind of crowdsourcing. Quite often, I hope I'm not getting anyone into any trouble, but sometimes quite often, if you're drinking with anyone associated with the show, they'll ask you.
Yeah.
They will say, have you got any, like, so they're quite good at kind of asking people or my ex-boyfriend came up with a task. He's really good friends with Alex and he came up with the idea of like making Marmite.
Great.
Which is just such a great idea. Just the idea of like you can ask for anything, like, and the closest approximation to Marmite wins.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love it. So who were you on with? I'm not going to make this a whole episode about Taskmaster.
I was on with, and because they tend to have a kind of formula, and I was on when it was still only one woman. So it was Rob Beckett.
Yes.
It was Dave Gorman.
Rob won, didn't he?
Rob won, yeah. He was brilliant. And Paul Chowdhury, he was such a silly Billy.
Yeah, he was great.
Dave Gorman and Al Murray, they were like the grown-up clever boys.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Dave was the one that I was kind of, I think, because I've known of his, or because of how he came to popularity, it's all quite...
Yes.
Thought.
Oh, he's so intelligent.
He's so clever.
Both him and Al Murray are
so
really clever.
I actually thought, Dave's going to win. And I think it was enjoyable watching him get annoyed when he didn't
Fantastic.
Do well.
Because
it was like... You should be smashing all of these.
Yeah, because he was so good at thinking laterally.
Yeah.
And Al Murray kept bribing everyone. He kept spending his own money on things.
Yeah. But I love, again, it's the ludicrousness of it all. Like, Paul Chowdhury is one of my favourite Taskmaster guests ever. I wasn't that aware of him at that point. And he was just so...
When they said he was doing the series, he was one that I was... Because I'd done stand-up with him before and some stand-up shows. And I was like, oh... Okay, and then the second it started, I just loved it so much. I loved him and everything he did, and he's one of those comics, actually, who has an exceptionally strong clown, and that's what was really clear in Taskmaster.
Yeah.
It never looked like he was being stupid on purpose.
Yeah.
But no one can be that stupid.
He just held it so well, particularly in the studio bits, so kind of...
There was one task that was just him by himself. Or maybe there was a day where it was all tasks that only got Paul to do, and one of them was on a bouncy castle, and it was just, I think of it often, just how happy it made me. Paul Chowdhury on a bouncy castle.
I love it. But also, again, because you can look and go, well, logically, here's who I think will win, a Dave Gorman or this or that.
Yes, yeah.
But then it never works like that, because logically, when I saw Lou Sanders was on this series, I was like, I love Lou. It's going to be hilarious.
It's going to be
She's not going to get a single point, but it's going to be wonderful.
Yeah.
And she absolutely smashed it.
Absolutely smashed it.
The studio tasks was, it became just my most exciting thing because about four in a row, she just won easily. Everyone was trying really hard. She go, there you go.
Yeah.
I've won
Absolutely brilliant. That's the thing, actually, because that's why it's such a great format, because the stuff that Greg judges is so arbitrary. It isn't like who is the best. It's who Greg thinks is the best, which in itself is that... nonsensical.
Which then becomes enjoyable because there is literally everyone else will have a reason to get annoyed because they'll be like, well...
Yeah, because it's literal favouritism.
The best. Like,
Greg just finds some people more charming than others, yeah.
I love it. Well, there's a lot of things I want to talk about.
Yeah.
Taskmaster was on here, but it wasn't going to be something I was going to be focusing on loads. So, but I'm glad we got that in there.
Yeah.
You've just been up to an awful lot since you last came on, haven't you? It's been a hell of a time.
Yes.
And genuinely, it's weird because we've met a handful of times, I guess. I've come to see your shows a few times and things like that. But because you're on so much stuff that I'm into, it feels like we catch up all the time.
Well,
I've seen loads of you. It feels like, oh, Sarah's a really close friend. I'm like, oh, we've actually met like four times ever. But But before we get into any of that, the really important bit is you've got a dog.
Yeah.
And that's really the most exciting thing. There's TV shows, there's books, there's all sorts
of things. And all those things have got me to the point where I could buy a flat so I could get a dog.
Exactly.
It was all stepping stones to being truly happy.
So how exciting has it been? His name's Mouse.
His name's Mouse. I'm obsessed with him.
Yep. So am I. And I've never met him. So.
Well, I was actually thinking on the way here, I should have checked if I could bring him because I would have brought him to meet you.
Well, there's a studio dog.
Oh, is there? Well, sometimes,
called Neville, who's fantastic.
Well, the trouble is, because he's still a puppy, he reacts really badly to other dogs' territory indoors. Yeah. He's lovely outside, but I took him to a meeting last week where he'd been fine the week before, but this week they had a dog and he weed on someone from Sony's bag.
Oh, wow.
And he didn't take it great.
No, I'd imagine not. That's not a good negotiation.
Like, you should take your dog outside. And I was like, that's not what this is. this is territory marking.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with him. I've got this quite a codependent relationship at the moment. But he's just the most incredibly clever dog and very affectionate and very confident.
He looks like a cartoon dog.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. It really just looks like it's a kid's cartoon dog. Yeah. Like they've literally drawn that or the HMV dog or a spot the dog type thing. It's
just so incredible. This woman had him around the corner. She'd had him since he was about 5 weeks old and she'd bought him for an autistic son. And then I think the puppy was far too young to be with her and the son hadn't taken to the dog. So she put something up on like a local residence page. It's like, I can't cope with this puppy. And I just walked around and got him. And I'd only moved in like 2 days before. So getting the dog was like in 2 months' time when things have settled down and I had some furniture.
Yeah. I love it because, again, I'm a big fan of adopt, don't shop.
I think rescuing
dogs is really important.
Yeah,
if there's a dog that hasn't settled or isn't working, and that's a
Well, it's also that thing. I mean, it might be the same with you. When your life has, I'm at home most of the time writing. My life has the luxury of flexibility, so I'm really good. I know he has an amazing life with me.
Yeah, like, it's tough. It's the reason I've put off getting a dog for so long, and I want to kind of discuss that. Do you think the spontaneity of it helped it happen? Because I think it's so easy, particularly in anything in entertainment where you might have a gig that comes in that means you have to be away for a month or this might happen
happen. What I found quite good about having a dog, and this is why I think if it's something that anyone listening, because I think like lots of people, we know how lovely that relationship will be, but we might have to make sacrifices. I have a really good judgment now, which must be what happens to people when they've had children. Well, when I get offered a job, I think, is it worth leaving my puppy for? Yeah. And that includes whether it's an hour out of the house or if it's going to be 2 weeks away. And I'm really lucky that other people in my family have got dogs. So when I do have to go away, I can take my dog there and he has company and other dogs. So it's like he goes and stays with his cousins, basically. Yeah.
I love it. I bring it up constantly now, but I don't think I do. But I belong to a website called borrowmydoggy.com.
Yes,
And I use that because, again, it's that exact thing of when I am about... Mm. I'm the perfect situation to have a dog because I'm at home a lot. I'm doing my own work. I can go out. I can take an hour's walk.
Yeah, and it's good to get out of the house, isn't it? Because the other thing is, if you have to do work at home, the thing that makes you leave the house in any weather and get your face rained on and not be looking at your phone, you go, oh, that's the most therapeutic thing I could have done.
Yeah,
it's constant. I love watching a little dog just sniffing around bushes and running after a ball. I think it's really good for the heart.
Yeah. Completely. I've found a dog. I've borrowed a few and I found one recently that's only like a 15 minute walk away from me.
Perfect.
So it's the perfect kind of, at any point, I'll be like, is Mac about?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you can take him over to the park. I'm like,
that's so nice, isn't it? But I did wonder though, on a darker note, has anyone been murdered yet via the Borrow My Doggy app?
You see, that's what I wonder, because as soon as I posted about it, people were like, oh, did they do checks and this and that? It's like, well...
No, it's all the trust
just
system.
Relax a little bit. Because again, it's weird that the world's changed. Because
of course,
when I was growing up, there was a lot more that was just, nah, they'll be all right.
Of course.
They'll be fine.
But also, it would be such a weird, convoluted thing. If you wanted to rob someone, your first thought wouldn't be, I'll go around and take their dog for a walk.
Yeah.
If people want to rob you, they're going to do those kind of things anyway, aren't they?
Yeah, completely. Yeah. So it's a weird one. But any time I've posted about it, I've had some people say, so what's the deal? Is there any, are they checked? Are you vetted? Yeah. No, just...
Also, someone crossed the road to tell me the other day, they didn't have their dog with them, but I did, and they crossed over the road to kind of pet him, and they said, all people who love dogs are good people. which I don't know that's necessarily a scientifically proved fact, yeah. but I think there is something about people yeah, who want to take care there. Of animals. Yeah.
You see, I weirdly, everyone I've taken out, I don't know if this is normal on the website, but I've arranged to come round and meet them first.
Yeah.
So before I, so rather than say, oh, I'll come round and take them out, it's like, yes. I'll come round on Monday and we'll meet.
Yeah.
And then later in the week, best. I'll take them. Because yeah. it just feels...
You don't want,
responsible,
you don't ever them to be worrying like, who is this person and am I going home?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
There's a place in Enfield that I like. Basically, it's these men who used to work at Battersea, and they opened up a big doggy daycare centre on a farm.
Wow!
And then they also use the proceeds for that to adopt dogs that aren't going to get adopted. So they have somewhere to run outside, and they train them. And so it's such a beautiful setup, and they don't let you just drop your dog off there. You have to go with the dog yourself and walk around the farm and meet everyone.
Right, that's brilliant.
So that the first time they go there, they've been there before and they know everyone. So I think it's so sensible.
Yeah, completely. I think in general it'd be good if, I don't know, again, because as on the idea of people who love dogs are good people, not all people who get dogs love dogs,
no.
and that's the problem with dogs who think
they can cope with it, because I was really surprised. So like I say, the puppy, when he came to me, was 8 weeks. I was really surprised. I'd never been around a puppy that young before, about how much he needed. And you have to teach them every behaviour that they should have learned with their mum and the other puppies. So not only is it kind of obviously going to the toilet everywhere at all times of the night, but they also think they can eat everything, including the wires for your Wi-Fi. Like, they've got this tiny little mouth with these little sharp baby teeth. And it was constant. And luckily, I could afford to have like a puppy trainer come round to the house. All these things, I thought, what would you do if you were on low income? Because if I'd had to leave the house at 9 every morning and come back, actually, it would have been a horrific situation where I'd have been shouting at a dog. Or some people still believe that you educate a dog by scaring them, by being like an authority figure, even though all the evidence shows you absolutely don't. It's just like children, you reward them when they do it right, and they learn really quickly. But it's a luxury to be able to watch YouTube videos learning how to interact with your dog.
Yeah.
Like, it just needs time.
Well, to have the time. I was going to say to have the time as well to put, and it's a tough one, because I've said for ages now, I think, because any time there's any controversy about a dog attacking something and people saying, oh, this certain breed should have to be muzzled or whatever else. I don't agree with that. I think people should have to do testing to show that they're allowed to have a dog.
It's a bit like with negligent parenting. What you realise is they have to be supported in looking after the dog. So a little bit like with children, it's not like then punishing the owners, because it always then ends up punishing the animal.
Yeah, yeah.
So if people want to have dogs, unfortunately we don't have this kind of society, but they should be really supported in their training of the dog, so that...
But then
the dog isn't,
I mean, it applies exactly to parenting as well, because it's the same thing. There's some literally almost said the sentence, there's some children that shouldn't have been born. But there's some children that shouldn't have been born into the situations that they've been born into. That it's not fair on them,
of
and not just.
Not.
So
yeah.
not saying they shouldn't have been born, that there should either have been more support or something to go right.
Yeah. I'm obsessed with this study by a man called, I'm sure his name's David Olds. And so they had... I'm pretty sure it was America, but if it wasn't, I'm quoting everything wrong about it, but it's fascinating. What they decided to do was randomly get groups of women who were 3 or 4 months pregnant.
Yeah.
And the reason it was random is they wanted to see the difference in terms of people's ages or their income level. And they were trying to show that the state should support parents better. And so what they did is that these people had 3 or 4 times the amount of midwife visits when they were pregnant. So this and so these visits included all kinds of health in terms of like relaxation or yoga or diet, and they were taught in lots and lots of things that they would need to know when the baby came. So some of these mothers are single mothers who are teenagers, some of them are married middle class women, and then they went back to those children at different stages in their lives, so that the support carried on while the child was like 1 and 2, and then they had no involvement.
Right.
They found aggression levels when they were 3 and 4 were much, much lower in the children that had this support. And then when they were much older, what they know is how the rates of mental health problems and criminality, and they found that the biggest results were in the low-income young mothers, and their children were far less likely to have depression, bipolar, or go to prison, which saves society so much money. And so they found out that for every dollar spent on these midwife visits, they saved society $3.
Wow.
So it's this amazing costing.
That's amazing.
But people
yeah.
think that that kind of like state mentality is wrong
yeah.
and there are some bad people. But actually, no, it has to be. If, if you're kinder to people, they then have the room or the knowledge to be kinder to their children.
Yeah, completely. I mean, one of the things that I've always loved about your work is you'll regularly talk about challenging the societal norms of how a relationship should be, how parent, how all these different things should be. And it's a similar thing there in that we have this societal norm of, oh, you just know, like when you become a mum, you just know.
Yeah.
You just know. It's like, that's a huge amount of pressure. Because number one, that's kind of believing in magic.
Mm.
It's kind of, you'll just know. But,
yeah.
but number two, it makes it even worse when you don't.
When you don't.
When it happens and you don't, you feel that you're failing as a mother, that you're a bad mother.
You're
it's
panicking.
Like, well, no.
But also,
it's mad to think anything in the world that, well, when you start it, you'll know. You don't go to pilots, you'll know.
Yeah.
Well, when you're up there, you'll know how
to land.
That's
it, yeah.
You'll figure it out.
There's the buttons.
Yeah.
It'll feel natural. I think,
crazy.
And also so much of it is economic.
Yeah.
That for mothers who worry about money, who worry, the idea of people failing and how horrible that makes them feel about themselves. And then also if people do have kind of, you know, like rage, because people get that because of frustration. And if you have that with young children, you're in a vicious cycle of hating yourself and not being able, and then feeling judged by society and working three jobs and then having letters home from school saying, can you read more with your children?
Yeah, completely.
Yeah.
And the fact is, if you don't really know, if you're feeling lost, then it's likely, this isn't to put any pressure, but it's likely to have a negative effect on the child.
Of
Therefore,
course.
You're going to have a more difficult child. So you're going to have a parent
because you're going to have a symbiotic,
and is a really troublesome
a child who needs more
up.
Attention, or a child who also is experiencing frustration and they don't know why they don't feel safe.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah.
And it's right to flag it on a economic as well, because one of the things that Rutger Bregman talks about when he's talking about a universal basic income is the studies he looked at in Utopia for Realists all showed that when you don't have to worry about the basics of hunger and stuff like that, you can excel far more in... Because, again, I think the example he gave was, if you're going into an interview, you want to be calm and you want to be able to nail that interview and whatever else.
It can't
if
be
you've not
or
slept
death.
That night and you're hungry and you're worried about this, you're not going to perform well.
Yeah,
and that's the same
or
with
even
parenting.
If you're going into a job going, if I don't get this, I can't eat tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's too much pressure. When they say, why do you want this job? You're like, because I'm hungry. Because you feel that you have choices in your life.
Yeah.
I think the more that people find out about universal basic income, and also the more studies that they do, because they have to do test groups to prove to people this isn't going to cost society any more money.
It came to mind because of what you were saying about the
you save
the midwives
money eventually.
Is that everything you spend, you save so much money on healthcare, on policing, on all sorts of
but
other things.
That's the trouble with the political system that most countries have, including us, is a binary system where there is never a kind of what they call it, like a group party initiative where they all group together and go, we have to do this for 20 years and that's when society is going to see a benefit.
Yeah.
They dismantle what the government before have done.
Yeah.
Yeah, or they think, I'm not going to get elected on that ticket. We're Tories. We can't say. This is eventually going to make us more profitable as a society.
Completely. And people love to highlight the issues or potential challenges. And it's something that a few people have highlighted, but they'll always highlight the challenges and problems as if we're in a system that works.
Yeah.
So, that wouldn't be ideal. That's like...
Because there'd suddenly be flaws.
What we've got now isn't ideal.
No.
That's the reason we're looking at it. That of course there's going to be issues and challenges. But
I had an idea I had in a dream, which I keep thinking about, but I don't know the practical. There would obviously be problems with it. But what if every currency only existed for 5 years? I was trying to think of a system where there was a resetting where people, like universal basic income, had a lower level, which was kind of uniform, that everyone, no one ever sunk below it, but at the same time really allowed and rewarded people who want to work really hard and innovate or who are just amazing. So as in, it's not trying to It's not trying to say people can't be rich. It's not trying to punish the rich with huge unfair, what they see as unfair taxing.
Yeah.
So I thought, what if you had every 5 years, you have a brand new currency, everyone gets a certain amount of it, so everyone starts at the same amount.
Yeah.
Then over 5 years, people can really flourish. But obviously, they're going to have to spend that money because it's going to stop existing. So you keep money moving around the economy. There's no point people saving it for themselves. You're going to have to buy stuff and services. And that means that that money's always moving around. That was my idea. But I haven't really...
It's really interesting. Yeah. It kills me. There was a paper I read, and I used to know, it's similar, I used to know the name of the guy and where
it was. Annoying now. All my conversations like, oh, it's so interesting.
I know that someone will be able to tweet me, because in a previous episode, I would have had it accurate, because it would have been fresher. But it was this economist who wrote about all this just before we went into society... we've got now, or the kind of economics that we've got now. And his idea was that everything has, and this is honestly, it sounds stupid, but the more you go into it, it's amazing, that everything has a set price. So headphones
they have
are £10.
Yeah.
All headphones ever are £10.
Yeah.
That means that there's no benefit on making cheap crap, because would you buy that? You'll buy the £10 ones that are good.
So the competitive nature, but then becomes quality, because everyone's spending £10 on headphones,
and for example,
you want them to choose yours.
Yeah, for example, a plumber is £50 a day.
Yeah.
That means the ones that are busiest are the ones that are really good and work really hard,
and
not the ones who say, I'll do it for 20 quid.
You'd rather wait for the one who's a bit busier, but you know, good quality.
It's really good.
It's really interesting.
And the best example I've now just realised out of nowhere is Ryanair wouldn't exist. Because the only reason Ryanair exists is because it's cheaper than everyone else. Everyone always loves to go online and moan about it. But the fact is, when we look at the prices, we go, that's 45 quid, though.
Yeah.
And the other one's 100 quid.
Yeah.
So if a flight to France was 70 quid, that's it. That's how much it costs.
I wonder if people would really revolt, because the median price that would be given would be probably a lot more in some instances. And people think, as in for flights, there wouldn't be 45.
Well, that's the reason it was so heartbreaking to read, because it can't come after capitalism. And it was written just before we got into the capitalism world. It's like, if we'd just started with that, it feels like everything you can go through. Again, there's going to be ups and downs. But again, it just means... All stuff will
have a higher
quality.
And also, you're not saying there isn't competitiveness in the market.
No, quality and taste and style and
amount.
Design.
I guess the thing that would be so revolutionary is housing. That houses would be what they are worth. Literally, square footage, how many windows, size of the garden.
Exactly that. Yeah. All of that coming into it. And you would have had, from the start, a lot more houses built that were, again, the average quality would be higher, because why would you pay a builder to build a cheap shit house when it's going to cost the same as that really nice one up the road because of the square footage?
And actually, that's where it might become interesting, like kind of state-owned or council housing.
Yeah.
That would be really interesting, because all of those flats or houses would be worth something.
Yeah.
When I was a teenager, I read a book. I read a book that was set on Mars, and it was a... it was a moneyless state. So very similarly, I had this utopian idea that if everyone did... And it's before I obviously ever heard of Karl Marx, but if everyone did things because they wanted to and swapped, and we had that kind of thing. But unfortunately, when you actually look back at a kind of pre-capitalist stage, it wasn't better. Like people just did, there were people who had absolutely nothing.
Yeah, it's tough because, again, all of these things, they're so easy. Most ideas at some point have been used poorly in history by humans.
And it's humans, like
communism. You can go, communism, look at communism. It's like, no, communism as system
an idea.
Can work.
Oh, so that's it. So
the corruption of it by humans.
Also, I think it's the enforcing of it. If you enforce any idea or philosophy on a person, even on a singular person, it's pure evil. Because it doesn't allow for human freedom and choice. So it doesn't matter how beautiful your ideal is. If we did communism at university but we were taught it with the understanding that it was set up, it was inspired by communes, like communes in Britain, and obviously the levellers and the diggers. And those things only really worked when you had a tribe size that kind of fit with the nature's tribe size of about 150 people. The minute you got too big as a commune, you completely collapse because you need a dictator.
Yeah.
So the whole thing, it's like you can compromise with a group of human beings. You absolutely can. But once there's too many human beings, you need someone in control and telling people what to do. And then it's not communism anymore.
Completely. I mean, it's a crazy one. It's all stuff that
it's exciting to be sitting here because it's all stuff that you can't discuss on Twitter. Because it's just too, it's not nuanced enough.
You can't have any discussion on Twitter.
Because there was a thing a while back where I was like, there are ways that a dictator, this is going to sound crazy, but that a dictatorship can work.
Yeah.
Because there's, it's one vision. And the fact is, the difference, the reason it came to mind was the current political system doesn't allow for any real change. It allows for slight leans either way when the people in power are
different. Oh, if you got rid of elections.
If there was a dictatorship, you get overthrown because it's not good, and then there can be huge change.
Well, that's it. So the idea of a benevolent dictator I've always found fascinating. So there's two really, and these are things that you'll be close to your heart as well. So there's two things that are not popular in terms of people, voters, so politicians can't support them. One of them is the decriminalisation of sex work, and one of them is the legalisation of drugs. Yep. And they're two things that absolutely everyone who talks with any kind of education around those topics knows they are actually better. They're problematic 100%. Areas.
Inarguably improving.
Yeah. But they're these two massive things, and yet it's we're not going to get a prime minister who suddenly goes, do you know what I'm really educated and informed about?
Yeah.
And can actually say in an absolutely unequivocal way, this will make this reflects people's human rights and will support people better. Yeah. And if you doubt it and if you're scared, let me tell you why you're like, it would be so brilliant. Yeah, let me explain it to you. But it would need a dictator to go, I don't care what you think.
We're going to do it.
Yes.
And then you'll see in 5 years how silly. It's going to be like the smoking
ban.
We're
going to do it. Don't question me.
Yeah. It's going to be like the smoking ban. There's going to be uproar, and then you'll go, oh, it's actually didn't make a big difference negatively, and it's really, everything's a lot nicer now.
Yeah.
It's really good for us all.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a bizarre one.
I think that's even the role of the state in kind of, and the Brexit is the prime idea, because it's no one's role to be educational. There isn't. I often think, what about if they were just like, just resources? Because they do have the research. Yeah. They have access to informed people. But there isn't any kind of sharing of it because people kind of don't want a state to go, I'm an adult, don't tell me, don't try and make me understand the EU.
Well, Brexit is the prime example of everything that we're discussing here, of a decision that shouldn't have been in our hands as a public, or at that point in particular.
Absolutely.
Because we just didn't have enough information. So I don't care about the arguing about, I voted this way, you voted that way. All of you voted in ignorance because none of you knew what the actual Brexit that you were voting for was.
I feel like it's like someone asking if you wanted a pie, but they didn't tell you what was in it.
Yes.
So it could be shit or it could be like apple or mincemeat. But so basically you go, do I want a pie or not?
And pie means pie.
Pie means pie. And then afterwards we'll find out what's in the pie.
Yeah.
It's like you can't pretend it. You just literally took a gamble on something.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough one because pie is rarely bad. Like pie generally, like it's got a high rate
of
delivery.
You could put a severed head in it. I know. But so people are going, in my experience, all the pies I've had haven't had a severed head. Yeah. But this time I'm going, come on.
But then when you open it and it has got a severed head and you go, well, it's what we wanted.
Yes.
We did want pie.
Yeah. Your pie.
Exactly. Did you see the documentary Three Identical Strangers?
No.
I'm rewinding back a little bit now.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, and there will be some spoilers here, but basically in the 80s, these two guys met, a guy went to a university and everyone was like, all right, good to see you. And he was like, what? And then it turned out he had an identical twin there.
Oh, and it was an identical twin he'd never met.
It was an identical twin he'd never met. And it was in the papers. And then a third saw the picture, went, that's me. And all three of them met. And it was this huge news story.
How were they separated?
Well, that's what is the spoiler here, is I'll give it because it's fascinating and it's for what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Because the only thing that annoyed me about the story, the documentary, is they quite rightfully went and followed the outrage because it was genuinely a social experiment.
Oh, it was.
Triplets had been taken away by, or had been put up for adoption, and they decided to put one in a working class family, one in a more middle class, and one in an upper class family, and see the differences.
Which is completely unethical. It's completely unethical.
But that was the thing
that annoyed me. You'd love to be able to do.
The documentary quite rightfully went down the route of how disgusting is this, and the outrage, and the trying to figure out, and there's tons of twists and turns I won't go into, but the thing that annoyed me was, well, now it's happened, let's at least look at the results a little bit more. Because as I said, as a but the study is fascinating. It's unethical, but
the trouble with one set of triplets is actually, no matter what happened with them, you can't really deduce anything because it's only really true. That's why you have to have big groups.
Yeah, a lot of triplets stolen from
but
their families.
I often think about it. You know that brilliant book, Never Let Me Go, and the idea that once they work out how to clone,
yeah,
all of us can have clones that if we need organs or healthy things,
yeah,
they can get it directly from
right,
them.
Yeah.
And it's such a spooky, sad thing because obviously our clones would feel like people,
yeah,
and they would have emotions and it would be incredibly cruel. So that book deals with it so exceptionally well. But there is another thing with that in the cloning thing is that we could then just clone twins. I was, yeah, thinking when I was writing my book about people that, so it hasn't been proven scientifically in any meaningful sense that pornography is damaging for children to watch. Mm-hmm. Most people, the majority of people, feel intrinsically, well, it must be. Or,
yeah,
or you have individual case studies where someone will say, actually, it was traumatic or it did ruin my sex life or for whatever thing. But it hasn't been proven with a wide scale study. And now lots of the people who watched porn as children are old, as in they're in their late 20s.
Yeah.
And they haven't found a study that proves it yet. So I was thinking the only – you would have to have twins. You would have to get twins.
Yeah.
And one of them would grow up in our society and the other one would have to grow up in some kind of utopian island where everything was,
yeah,
the same, but they don't have the internet.
Yeah.
And then you would have to test everything about them and their sexual performance and their sexual feelings and their attitudes to the opposite sex, et cetera, et cetera. And, yeah, it's completely unethical. So you'll never be able to do it.
Genuinely, I think about that kind of thing all the time,
yeah,
and aware – because that was it with this documentary. I was like – it's completely unethical.
In terms of their lives?
Yeah,
because
again,
it's on the grand
scheme.
In terms of their lives, did you deduce anything in terms of... So presumably,
you
so
really
two,
did.
Of, them the, got, the two of them got to the same university. Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Or that was it. I think one had dropped out and then the other one was going there,
yeah,
for the next year. It was some weird,
yes, yeah,
coincidence. Everyone was like, oh, you came back. And he was like, what?
Oh.
What are you talking about? And
yeah.
But yeah, it's bizarre, but it's a fascinating.
Well, the other thing that's very, very unethical but fascinating, and obviously not if it happened to you, was when they used to with people who had were born with what they considered to be non-typical genitalia, so either elongated clitorises or very small micro penises, when they just made them the other gender.
Right.
Do you know about this? So there was all of this gender reassignment. I feel like it went up to the 1950s. That what they would do is take the baby very quickly away from the parents and just kind of sort it out. Or sometimes parents were aware that they had children that were, I guess, on a chromosomal level,
yeah,
one sex, but were brought up as the other because,
yeah,
of misformed genitals.
I mean, that's,
and they thought, they thought they would, and that, but they thought it was so interchangeable, literally. And it's the way that some very essentialist people have an attitude to transgender people now. If you've got a penis, then you are a boy.
Yeah.
And
it's mad.
It's really mad.
It's mad how they were so open to it being interchangeable then.
But then it's
yet there's such a resistance now to, no, this is this, this is that.
But that's the thing. But it still actually comes from exactly the same place, which is the only differential is your genitals. Like,
yeah,
if you've got a vagina, you, yeah, are a woman, and no one without one is allowed to be one. Or if you say you are a woman, we'll quickly get a vagina then, and then,
yeah,
we'll believe you.
Yeah,
yeah,
then we'll be okay with,
yeah,
it.
Then
as
we'll
long
go,
as
okay,
we
now
can visually
she is.
accept it.
Yeah.
It's bizarre. I mean, you mentioned your book there, and that's one of the exciting things that's about to come out. How's,
yeah,
that been, and what's it about? It's,
yeah,
it's called Sex, Power, Money.
Yeah, so I wrote the first book, and the first book, in a way, was much easier for me to write. I wanted to, there were loads of stuff that I wanted to know myself about kind of evolution and female sexuality, and I'd read a few studies about things or learnt some stuff about body fat that I kind of wanted to share. So it was a very personal book, and it was about how the female body evolved. But in it, I didn't deal at all with pornography. And even though, like, porn affects all of our lives, because it also affects the people around us, even if people don't watch or consume porn themselves. But I knew as I was writing Animal that I'm very naive about porn. I've never watched it. I'd seen it like three times in my life. I was aware that my boyfriends watched it. And I knew that all I knew about it was from feminism. And I could kind of, like, in my peripheral vision, feel that that wasn't the whole story, because realistically what it was is probably I could hear in the distance sex workers saying sex work is work.
Yeah.
And but close up, all I had was that feminism and that porn was degrading to women. It degraded them in terms of society, and it made them just bodies and bits of bodies. So my second book, my thing was to try and it's mostly about pornography. It's some about sex work. And I interviewed people because obviously I have no experience. Mm. But I again wanted to look at it from a biological perspective. So I was really interested in the science of arousal. And I guess with this book, I was so aware that it wasn't just about women. That yeah. it, so much of it. So it's really about kind of male sexuality. There's lots of things that are kind of, I guess, that we've heard and then we believe, like the idea that men are much more visually aroused than women. So I'd heard that so many times. Yeah. Men are much more visually aroused. Men know instantly if they fancy someone just by looking at them. That's why men consume more porn. And that's kind of an incontrovertible fact. Like in every single country that has the internet, men watch more of it, a bigger variety, more regularly than women, yeah. even though that's changing.
And again, that's not to say that women don't watch it
It's a generalisation. It says yeah. nothing about the individual, yeah. but in terms of in general, and that's fascinating because I wanted to find out, well, why? Is this a biological truth or is it, because there are people who argue, oh, women have been taught to be ashamed of their sexuality, female sexuality has been oppressed for so long.
Sure.
So I was really intrigued about what research there had been. So that's the book, and it took much longer for me to write than Animal. And if I'm honest, I didn't want to finish it because every time I learned something or spoke to someone, I was like, there's still so much more to learn. But you do have to kind of stop at some point, not yeah. answering lots of the things that I wanted to know. I really wanted to know if I had this idea that empathy must decrease with arousal. There are some studies that show similar things.
Right.
They get it's a really interesting study. They got men to masturbate but not to come, and then they asked them questions. They asked them the same set of questions before and after.
Right.
So they would ask them things like, would you get someone too drunk so they agreed to have sex with you, all the way up to, would you have sex with an animal, all these different kind of things.
Yeah.
And so they asked them the quiz first, they got them to masturbate to halfway, and then they asked them the same questions again, and they found that yeah, they were more likely to have sex with someone underage, more like to agree to having sex with an animal. That was like 4 or 5%,
yeah.
but it went from 0 to 4%.
Yeah.
But I was interested because there doesn't seem to be that much. People don't pay for porn. And yeah. the majority of people, I did a thing with my mail out where I asked people, if you had to pay for it, like Netflix, £8 a month, you can still mm-hmm. look at everything. It's still going to be so novel. Yeah. There's still going to be 54 years worth of content on there. I'm not limiting your pornography. I'm saying, will you pay for it? And they all said no.
It's bizarre, isn't it?
It's bizarre, and I think it's ruinous.
Yeah.
I heard this idea that because people masturbate, and some of the people literally then go, I don't want to think about it again.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated in the idea that people masturbate regularly to stuff that they don't identify as their sexual preference.
Right.
Do you see what I mean? So someone might be, the idea that you might be very isolated, you might be in a marriage, but you might masturbate to a certain kind of porn, but never speak to your partner about that because yeah. they might go, what, you're into old people? And you go, no, it just makes me come. So that was what I was trying to research, and it's an area that is so non-exhaustive, but I have finished it. And then what I did is I've done 8 interviews as a podcast of people, because I really wanted, as well, you're so aware of people who don't have enough of a platform in our society,
yeah.
and I really didn't want to talk on anyone's behalf about porn or sex work. So instead what I've done is interviewed some people.
Amazing.
Yeah.
This is fascinating. It's so interesting psychologically. There's so much I want to jump into there. But the first, I think, is, like, I get a lot of praise on the podcast for these honest and open interviews, and it's generally all my guests who are being honest and open.
Yeah.
But it was interesting to hear the thing you were saying there about people want to watch it, and then as soon as they've come, pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I pay for a lot of my porn. Yeah. I don't pay for all of it, but I pay for a lot. But there's so many ways to pay now, and there's ways where you can do Patreons or subscribe to certain sites.
Yeah.
I don't subscribe to any, but I feel comfortable paying for a one-off thing. And I think that's a similar thing, that if I'm subscribing, I'm having to face it, and it's this, even though it's better value because it's a Netflix kind of system, but I'm more comfortable going, in this moment, I want to watch that. It's $8.99. I will pay for that. Rather than go, I'll pay £10 a month and I get to look
and
at this.
And I'm linked to this forever.
And that's fascinating. I'd never really thought about what the psychology behind it was.
I think it's really great that you pay in general. I think what people like about, well, there's two things. And the law's about to change here in terms of people are going to have to put in their bank details, their credit card details, whether they're paying for it or not, just to prove their age. But so there's two things. It's the anonymity. People feel really free to go. from one thing to another thing to another thing to another suggestion, because at no time are you actually...
You're feeling it, yeah.
Yeah, you're going, yep, I've made a decision about this and myself because of it. And the other side of it is I think we have such stigma around sex in general. It becomes even more amplified when people are paid to have sex. And people don't think they deserve to be rich. Yeah. And they do deserve to be rich. It should be like in any other
area. There's the illusion
of life,
that porn or sex workers don't pay taxes.
Yeah, well, they all do.
They all pay their taxes. But they're legitimate business, men and women.
They absolutely are. But what's terrible is that, I mean, in our country and in America, the things like not being allowed to have bank accounts, that the companies all have to be hidden, the idea that you're not allowed to make money from sex.
Yeah. Or the continual banning and shadow banning on Instagram of sex workers. Yes. Instagram is built off beautiful people and looking at beautiful people. They have the functions for gambling companies to have to click an ID thing, an over 18 thing. Why can't sex workers have that option? Say, all right, well, don't kick me off. Just make my page over 18. Yes. You've got the functionality there, because they have, as I said, they protect against gambling in that way.
Yeah.
Why is gambling more acceptable and legitimate than
also in this,
natural
desires? In this day and age, to have that much of a kind of, and it's Victorian, and I think it is, I think it's a very serious breach of people's rights to freedom of speech. Quite often when they're taking down strippers or sex workers' Instagrams, they're often quite politically active, controversial contrarians. Like, that's what's exciting about them. And if anyone does follow anyone like that, you'll realise there's a wisdom, there's a different view on society. It's not just pictures of sexy butts.
Yeah.
Like, there are pictures of people with sexy butts that are nothing to do with the sex industry.
Yeah.
And then they just disappear it. They take a whole... There are so many people who don't live in cities, who don't have a connection. So enabling people to connect online is a human right.
Yeah.
And when they disappear, then they don't tell them why they've taken their Instagram away. There's no recourse. Yeah. It's a very serious thing that people can, including myself, a stripper explained it to me, because I was like, but... And she's like, no, you have to talk you through why having tens of thousands of your followers disappeared and having to start all over again is actually massive.
Well, from a business point of view, I've got friends who've had business appointments and trips cancelled because they've lost their page, because they're models. Because part of the thing is, well, we're going to fly you out for this event or this thing for you to share. It's the same as any marketing. So to remove that is a big deal. It's not just followers and it makes me feel good. It's like, no, this is part of my business.
It's removing their ability to make money, which we consider in our capitalism a human right.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to... I found a lot of this out when we were trying to set up a union of comedians. You're not allowed to boycott a comedy club because you are then taking away someone's ability to make money, as in because comedians are actually the product that they sell. And I was like, wow, I had no idea. But of course you can't take away someone's right to a living. It's like they can't just shut the roads.
Yeah.
Because then a supermarket can't get their goods that they sell, things like that. And if you take away someone's Instagram, that is what you're doing. You're creating a boycott or closing the roads.
It's a really interesting one, because I've discussed it a lot with friends in that industry. And it's a tough one, because I do think we forget that Instagram is a private company and it's individuals. So they've got a right to make choices. But the problem is they've also got a responsibility to go, it's fair to say, well, we're scared about kids seeing things that they shouldn't be seeing. That's perfectly reasonable, I think, as a company. Yeah. But deal with that via age verification and stuff like that, not via getting rid of the people who built your site.
I would say the other way, because I think the idea that about protecting children is the exact wrong way to look at it. Because going back to what we were talking about before, if children are well supported by society, as in at every age they get to, there is education, discussion, safe spaces in terms of what the world contains. Because the world contains lots of stuff that isn't Father Christmas. It contains political beheadings. It contains sex.
Yeah.
It contains a variety of sexual behaviours. There are all these things that you think, there's an appropriate age to learn it. And it might be traumatic when you realise, we all die.
Yeah.
there's things, and it's about how we as a society support those children, not going, you can find out when you're 18. They're going to find out before that, all of those things, because of the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the thing, the focus should always be on not on making sure, because I think also if children don't have phones before they're 11 or 12, we're not looking at protecting 5-year-olds from sex workers. We're looking at children who are going to be so curious about those things. They're going to find them out anyway.
They should be being educated as it is. Yeah,
they just need other informed adults to be making sure they've got the whole spectrum of information.
Yeah, it's a fascinating one because I think the problem with, I mean, we've touched upon the two examples you gave earlier is sex work and drugs. The biggest problem is ignorance on all of them. And my brother highlighted a few years back, he kind of said the most damaging thing, or one of the most damaging concepts in society, is common sense, because it allows us to just assume that we know well.
Yes.
And that's really bad in the sex industry, because an example, and it's something I've learned in recent years from my partner, is a sex worker.
Oh, okay.
And what people don't understand is that sex work is a term for people who escort, people who strip, but also people who model, or people, or even photographers in the industry,
so this is the thing
come
I
down
had
to sex
to learn.
Work.
I was,
and so, that's where people just see sex work and go, well, it's prostitutes, it's illegal. It's like, no, there's so many other things in the area. It can also be modelling and all sorts.
Sometimes people think they don't. So this is an area I was incredibly ignorant about, and I'm now trying to learn a lot more about, because I would have definitely fallen into your first area of, like, I knew escorting.
Completely.
But I didn't know. Same. So most people think they don't know a sex worker. They definitely do. They know someone who, and some people, it might have been at university. It might be now.
Yeah.
The majority of people who sell sex are mothers. It's something like 80%. There'll be one person that they might occasionally have a transactional relationship with.
Yeah.
Marriage historically has always been a form of sex work because women didn't have a way of making their own living. They were reliant on a man, and they were kind of, there's all these different forms of it that I think people have to understand. There's people, Crisis and Shelter are doing campaigns about it, because we have this term which is like sex for rent at the moment, and the government recently were asking people about it. But actually it's a form of desperation which has always existed, where we've got a lot more homeless men than women, and the reason is quite often a woman can trade her erotic capital for somewhere to stay, whether that's dating someone she doesn't care about, whether it's, I had a friend who lived in a man's house, and he had he gave her very, very cheap rent, and he liked to masturbate in her room. There are all these forms of it, and actually again it's stigma and it's fear that we have, or we have a deep-seated idea that it must be very harmful to somebody.
Yeah.
Because what I realised was that quite a lot, and it's what happens with feminism, you want to protect people from things you wouldn't want to happen to you. So it can come from a really nice place. You go, I don't want sex work to be decriminalised because I actually think some men are really abusive to women.
Yeah.
And it was me learning, oh, and you make those women much more in danger when you make it illegal or criminal to do those behaviours.
100%.
You make them more vulnerable. You're not helping them.
It's easily comparable to drugs in that the easy example I had Neil, I've forgotten his surname, a policeman on, a former policeman, and he works with Leap UK. And the way he described it was, if you are worried about your children having exposure to drugs, then the best solution is to legalise it.
Yeah.
Because it's easier to get drugs for a 15-year-old than to get alcohol.
Yeah.
Because to get alcohol, you have to go into a shop and have ID.
Yeah.
The guy in the park isn't asking for ID on your alcohol. And similarly with sex work, the nasty, horrible people aren't going to be like, oh, it's illegal, I'd best not do that. But if there was legalised versions and safeguards and all sorts of other things. And it's similar, it's where this new porn legislation is coming in. It is putting sex workers in greater danger, because on the escort side of things, it's the internet where they can have some kind of barrier and vetting and safety.
Which is why Foster and Sisters had such a terrible, in America. It's been very persuasively done. I mean, There was a podcast I was listening to. It was Reply All, I think. And basically, one of the women who spoke to Trump's government about back pages where sex workers were advertising for clients, is that there was also trafficking going on, and her 16-year-old daughter was, like, murdered on her birthday. So it's the worst thing you've ever heard. Like, it's the most horrific thing. Underage sex isn't sex, it's rape. It doesn't matter if you're paying for it or not. And that's the word trafficking, kind of, so obviously so emotive, so awful. But they created a law which has made people, adults selling sex, so much more vulnerable, because, as you say, they used to be able to, from home, look up people's Facebook, check their car registration. They had so many tiers of checking. And now, if you're working outside, quite often it's a split second of judging, do I feel safe with this person? Has my alerts gone off? Is my the hairs come off my arms where I go, something's dodgy here?
Yeah.
But people, that one story is so persuasive about a 16-year-old girl being trafficked and advertised online that you think, well, that's then, yeah.
That's it. I mean, as I said, though, and it's right, it's something that people on both sides of the argument have to remember is it's normally trying to come from a positive place.
As people said, are good.
When people are getting angry, when sex workers are getting furious over it, it's understanding that a lot of the people who are against this, again, not realising that prostitution and sex trafficking are two different things.
Completely
it's not
different.
The same
one of them
world.
Will always be illegal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's not saying, that's okay.
The reason we call it like a statutory rape, we use the word rape when it's a child who we consider not old enough to give their consent. That's always the law. It doesn't affect consenting sex. Yeah. It has nothing to do with adults having sex with each other.
Yeah.
And that's, again, the same separation, which is why, and I'm sure you completely agree with me, and I hope your listeners do too, it's like all of this stuff, we just have to be talking about it more.
Completely.
It has to be a really, and the same with the drugs. There's so many things that ignoring them is making it worse. Yeah. We have to be more engaged with it. Even if, first of all, like you might have an emotional reaction going, I think prostitution must be wrong. But that doesn't mean you don't think about it more or listen to a sex worker's podcast or read. There's so many books and resources for people to actually, even if they feel like they don't know anyone, you can hear a different perspective.
Yeah, completely. And it's smashing those taboos, essentially.
Yes.
It's stopping them being taboo and in every way. An example I can think of is when the Louis C.K. stuff came out and people kept talking about how creepy it is that he wants to masturbate in front of someone. It's like, that's not the issue. His turn on isn't the issue. That's people can be turned on by whoever on.
Well,
the issue is that if he didn't have consent, if of this
course,
or that,
and
it's
the,
not
the power dynamic.
Oh, imagine that creepy old man doing that. It's like, no, don't say that because that's making a taboo of what someone's into.
Isn't
that's
it interesting
their private.
How you can remain sex positive and also go the whole thing of lots of people who have different. I love the phrase like, "Don't yuck someone's yum."
About
kink shame.
Yeah.
Don't yuck someone's yum. Because, again, we're all kind of very emotive creatures.
And you can emotionally, naturally do that, but don't put it online. Because, again, it's perfectly fine
and
as well to go,
it.
Oh, that's not my thing.
And also, some people you'll be speaking to, you have shamed them to go, oh, if that's your thing. Most people who have a variety of kinks, rolling consent is all such an important part of the conversation.
Yeah.
Including actually with lots of pornography that's made, that understanding that that's part of it, that you can be a porn worker and there's still some acts on the day that you don't consent to or don't want to do, and it might be things you do on other days you do feel like doing
and
them. Like,
similarly, a power dynamic and all things like that, where it can be. There's the ignorance. People think of porn and don't realise that because of the damage that Pornhub and Free Porn did.
Yes.
There's so much porn now made that is the individual performer being their own producer, cameraman, everything, doing it all themselves and being the person selling it, which in many ways is a positive thing because that means you're going the profit is going direct to the person involved. So porn equally isn't as black and white as studios and men exploiting women to make money.
Yes. Well, actually, again, some people are made more vulnerable by like the gonzo porn, the people who can prey on an individual the first time they decide to make porn. The other side of it, I interviewed Anna Arrowsmith. I don't know if you know her, but she was Britain's first female pornographer under the name Anna Spann. And she had all of her work stolen and then couldn't afford to keep running her company. And so she was in that very... it's the same business model as an independent film company who went, I could have made incredible things, but essentially I had £30,000 worth of what I should have got in profit stolen from me by, as you're kind of talking about, the tube sites.
Yeah.
So I couldn't afford to make any more. Yeah. So you just literally shut off what might have happened and flourished.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to see what people see as acceptable to steal. Because, again, the fact that you said that all these people asked and everyone's saying I wouldn't. I had an argument with someone on Twitter because I said, I can't remember what I said, and they just said, I watch my porn for free. And I said, well, you should support porn.
Yeah, you should
do this, blah, blah. And he came back quite fairly, really, going, dude, I'm 15. as soon as I'm old enough. And I was like, I literally didn't know what to say. I was like, dude, yeah. I'm 15. As soon as I'm old enough, I will. But for now, you know I can't. What? And I was fair enough.
You can shoplift. Really, but it's like shoplifting, isn't it? If a 15-year-old is shoplifting cigarettes, or no, I know you can't get cigarettes, but something, you go, okay, fair enough.
Yeah,
but then if you're 25, you can pay now for your sandwiches.
I really tweeted and thought he can't reply to this in any way, and he just came back going, "Dude, I'm 50." I was like,
"Also, it wouldn't be we all be so much nicer to each other if we assumed everyone else on Twitter was 15. We'd be so sweet if you always thought, hang on, 100%. I don't need to shout at that person. I don't need to block that. It's just like they're 15.
I've had a realization that because I'm not ashamed of it. I'm still a big fan of wrestling. I think wrestling is really good fun.
Yeah.
And there was a period where I'd see, there's a few pages I follow on Instagram and some comments would be stupid and I'd go to argue. Then I'd go, they're 15. It's a 15.
Yeah.
I'm the weird adult that's watching this thing that shouldn't be getting angry. And it stopped so much anger on those sites. It's like, okay, you're allowed to be a Wally.
But also it's remembering that nothing useful often can come out of the discussion.
Yeah.
I especially think, because you have a podcast, you get to outline how you think, you get to have like big discussions like beat by beat and thought by thought, and some people don't have that ability. So that's why online, a forum or a thread, that is their chance to do it. I always think I would stand up if I think something, if I have a response to what someone's tweeted, I can go and talk about it that night on stage to people. And so I never feel
you've got that outlet.
And again it's like luxury. I feel so lucky to have it. And I know people blog and some people create their own content to do that, or they vlog and they YouTube and stuff. But it must be so hard if you just, no one is listening to you when you're going, I think that film is racist.
Why
is no one listening to me?
Saying great things about it. It's really racist.
It's actually not.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Alive, and one of the things I wanted to talk about is your Lads tour and show. Tell me a bit about it. Because you've done some great... I'm interrupting now, but just to give... The shows I've seen have been some wonderful ones where you're dissecting history and history from a woman's point of view and where feminism comes into it, things like that. So this one looks interesting because in a way it seems more personal, because it's not looking, or it's looking at very recent history in many ways.
Well, do you know what, part of it, my stand-up changed, especially what I wanted to put into a show, changed when I started writing books, because the history show became the book animal, and then suddenly every day I had this kind of outlet for serious thoughts, and the books are still like funny, but not like, and stand-up in a way became a much more flippant space for me, that I now touch stuff with a lightness that I really... It's like I have this yin and yang, which is really healthy for me, that I'm really serious in the day. And like we've been talking about kind of universal basic income. But if I was going to do a joke about universal basic income, like I've got a joke about veganism in Lads, which is me doing an impression of a penis inside me. And that it's so silly that there's in no way would be like a lecture about veganism. There's no point made by it. And so it's been really enjoyable for me now, because I have this place where I can be really serious, so I don't have to be serious at work anymore.
It's fascinating because it goes back to outlets.
Yes.
Again, you found a different outlet for the more serious stuff, and now you've got an outlet for... Yeah.
And an appropriate outlet, because the thing with comedy, and obviously people use it in a variety of different forms, but it is supposed to be funny. Yeah. And I know that some people love the comedians that are much more kind of informed or educational, but I sometimes feel... My fear was always, like, never become a lecturer.
Yeah.
Someone who goes, we need to have universal basic income. Yeah. Capitalism has been torn down, here's why.
I mean, we're going to talk about your new Dave show at the end.
Yeah,
So there's an irony there.
Literally lectures. Yeah. But actually,
comedians giving lectures.
Very silly lectures, though. No one actually... Actually, one person did. One of my favourite episodes, a comic... because they could do whatever they wanted with their titles. They're all titles of very famous TED Talks.
Right.
And some people did attempt to kind of put it like a TED Talk, and other people completely didn't. But one person did.
I love it.
Quite a serious...
That's the concept. You've kind of given comedians different TED Talk lectures titles, and they've gone,
And then they go away and write them.
It's genius.
People did... It was really lovely watching how individual comics are. It isn't really... It's such a wide genre, which is obvious, but seeing people against each other made it really clear. But, Jen Brister is a really brilliant political, angry comic, and her lecture, it was about... the 1% and how they're getting richer and the political system is working for them, and then had this kind of joke. But it wasn't a joke. It kind of seared through everyone about what happened after Notre Dame and what happened after Grenfell. Mm-hmm. And if you read it on the page, you're like, oh, my God, this is a comedy show.
Yeah.
But the people in the room, and they're a comedy audience, but she got such an ovation for it because
amazing.
In the midst of all of this, she said something that was so astute and it was so powerful and brilliant.
It's the beauty of balancing light and dark,
exactly.
right? The spoonful of sugar type approach to go, right, now I'm going to have this.
Yeah.
The impact of this is going to be all the grander because we're messing about. It's why the right for comedians to joke about anything needs to be protected so vehemently because it is. It's like as soon as you start to censor that, number one, it ruins the fun.
Yeah.
And number two, it ruins the impact that can be had.
Yes. Well, actually, there's a really good example of that. I mean, because I don't think it shouldn't just be comedians, but everyone, the whole freedom of speech debate. But there was a year when and it was completely understandable that there was a charity that supports rape victims, and they had all these keychains that they wanted comedians to have. And essentially, it was like a promise that you weren't going to do rape jokes.
Right.
And you can see why they thought this would be a great idea. They said, so let's have a rape joke free festival. Let's comics stop doing rape jokes. And the reason people don't like rape jokes is it seems to belittle, be very flippant about something that sometimes is the most traumatic thing that ever happens to somebody.
Yeah.
And because rape jokes has been such a big part of comedy, because it's one of the worst things that can happen to a human or that you can imagine. So that's why it's been joked about. It's not because people don't care about rape.
Completely.
It's actually a bit like how they joke about babies dying or someone like Anthony Jeselnik. The reason he jokes about killing babies or dropping them down the stairs is because that's the worst thing you can imagine.
Yeah. He's the best example because I've not played his jokes to anyone and them not laugh. They'll say that wasn't really right, but he writes them and
perfect.
Structures them so well that it's like, here's the most offensive thing ever. You might go away and write a tweet saying how offensive this is, but you're going to laugh before you do it because it's so perfectly written.
I think he's one of my favourite comics. I think it's glorious how perfect his comedy is. And for me, I feel like it's cartoony. It's nowhere near the sense of what he's saying. It's a bit like why someone explained roasts to me because I was like, isn't it just calling women slags and being racist? They're like, yeah, but that's the language of it.
Yeah.
Like, that's the language, is you say the worst things. And so, so with the rape joke thing, I was trying to explain to the woman that, like, Bridget Christie can't do her show if you can't joke about rape. And Hannah Gadsby's show, Nanette, the most successful comedy show of all time, they would say couldn't happen. And that's a really complicated thing. I know they don't want bad jokes. They don't want anyone in the audience to think rape isn't serious. They don't want people laughing about something that they're trying to...
But as soon as you're taking it off the table, you're not treating it. It's saying it shouldn't be talked about, which again, is really damaging, particularly in the situation of rape, because it's making people feel... that they can't tell their story,
a rape victim can't joke about their own experience. We joke to reclaim quite often.
Yeah.
I think, so again, it comes back to the thing like with the children. It's like, society needs to change. Rape needs to stop, and then there won't be any rape jokes.
Yeah.
When we understand rape better, we support the victims of rape or survivors of rape better.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what we do. Put our effort into that and worry less about. Yeah.
Yeah. I like what Sophie Hagen does with her trigger warnings of what, because again, I completely understand that if there's countless subjects that if they've affected you personally, you don't want to hear that on a night out.
Yeah.
And I get that, but still, that's not a reason for it not to exist. That's a reason for you to not attend that particular set.
I think especially with someone Sophie Hagen, what she was realising is that she wanted to attract a certain audience, especially, and Felicity Ward's similar, actually. She wants to talk about anxiety and mental health, and that means that sometimes you might have to be more considerate of your audience.
Yeah.
And there's lots of people who have that. I don't do any crowd work because personally I know how horrible it can be when you feel that you're being picked on by a comic who needs it to be funny. There's a form of bullying to it that some people just absolutely love.
Yeah.
Some comics flourish on it. I just don't do it.
I mean, it also encourages something that I feel is negative in where comedy has blown up so much and it's become so mainstream.
Mm.
There's a lot of people who feel that it's perfectly acceptable to be part of the show.
Yes.
And I think that can really derail comics.
Yeah.
I've seen that really derail,
so
particularly
different.
Personal shows. Where there's a personal show, it can be really kind of damaging to have someone go, shout something out. Like, no, not now.
Yeah, and it irritates the rest of the audience.
Even when they're trying to, again, I've seen it where people are trying to be positive and helpful and trying to just, I'm a good guy, this is all good, but it can derail things.
Well, that's it. So, because I spoke about Hannah Gadsby a second ago. I went to see her show at the Soho Theatre, which was probably a year after I'd seen it in Edinburgh, and the ending of the show, which is absolutely pivotal, and it's absolutely kind of pin drop times a million in terms of how charged she and the audience are, and a woman shouted out, "We love you," which, as you say, comes from such a beautiful place. And then Hannah just went, "Oh, I can't do the last line of the show." Like, you just, what, just, okay. It's, and she just walked off.
I wouldn't have specified it, but it's weird. I saw James Acaster in Brighton recently, and he had a really similar thing where there was a pivotal point and someone shouted out something positive, and it derailed, particularly him knowing that the last half or third is really the most personal stuff he's written. So it was still amazing. He still did it. But I could tell, as someone who knows James, I was like, he's heartbroken, because I was like, that's fucked it up now. That's ruined it for him.
It's ruined it for him. It's ruined his night. Because you're watching a craftsperson. It's the reason people don't do it in plays.
Yeah.
Is they understand that the experience of the play for everyone else involves kind of suspension of disbelief and believing it. You don't want to remember you're in a crowd full of people. You want to just, you want to go to a different plane where those people are real.
Yeah.
And the playwright is talking to you through them. And some comics use stand up like that. Yeah. James wrote something really funny on Twitter the other day about how could he do his stand up without the audience being there? Because
after that night.
Yes.
He said
he gets shouting a lot.
Yeah.
And it's so ridiculous because he is probably the primary crafts person in comedy. 100%. Like, he's so up there. Comics and audiences alike realise the quality of what he's doing.
Oh, his Netflix shows an example of that. The fact that they're all trilogy, woven, it's this amazing thing. So it's mad to think you'd be at the show
and then just,
and not realise that we need to sit back and
So I asked him, I said, so why is it? Because I thought, I mean, I know he's done a lot of Mock the Weeks, and he said, no, it's the people the person brings. It's the person who doesn't know you.
Yeah.
And obviously, quite often we do that. We've got a favourite thing. We bring a partner, a friend from work. We take a group together, and it's those people that shout at him because their experience of comedy is either on TV or it's a live club where the best stuff comes when you... He said he had a horrible one in Tunbridge Wells. I'm telling someone else a story, but where he's got a really amazing routine about Ricky Gervais and transphobia. Amazing routine. And it's amazing for a comic like James to do that because he's usually like about ducks and getting annoyed. Yeah. He does silly Billy stuff. So to have something that's so scathing and astute about transphobia and which still isn't shutting down that we can joke about anything, but it's a problem with his problems with a comic like Ricky Gervais punching down in that way. And then someone shouted out, "Fuck trans people."
Yeah.
And like, so his thing is so meticulous. It's not like a club where someone then can shut that person down.
Yeah. No, and that's it. Oh, that's the thing, because weirdly, I was talking about it on the way home with my partner. And again, if it's just you've gone to a comedy night, then that's a slightly different thing, because that's you've not gone to see a specific comedian. And equally, if you're in such a big room, it's so hard to then be, cut that person down, have that interaction.
Yeah, and then it kind of opens it up. And also, like, if you go back to the other thing is there's so much persona in comedy. So if you're James Acaster doing what James Acaster does, and you then call someone a cunt, you go, "Shut up, you cunt. I don't come to your work and hit the dicks out of your mouth." Yeah. And then you can't go back to being James Acaster because you just changed. You just changed who you are.
Yeah.
And that's the thing with comedy clubs, and even some of them have really changed. It isn't as kind of combative as it used to be, although that used to be the point. But the MC sets up the night. They come on, and the way they talk to the audience sets up to the audience how they can behave for the comics.
Yeah.
And I was never, ever, as I say, I don't like crowd work. So for me, it was hard when I did gigs that were like that. But I would understand the room's been set up that they shout at you.
Yeah.
And we know the hens are here, and we know it's Linda's 40th, and we know this. So I can't, while I might struggle with material, I can't say that they are wrong. More often, I'm a bad booking.
It's, it's what they know and what they expect. I mean, I for a long time have blamed Panto. They're brought up a generation of young people who think they're meant to be part of the show. You're not. Yeah. You're meant to sit there and enjoy it.
But I do understand. But sometimes, you know what? There's another side. It would be so similar. I wonder if there's a similarity with music in terms of like a right way and a bad way for an audience to behave. Because in music, the nightmare would be people being incredibly quiet, like they just have to be in awe of it. You don't. Yeah. You want them to tap their feet. You want them to be that they're feeling it in their bodies. Like, and the other thing,
a plane in Japan was exactly that.
Yes.
The first time I did a festival, or the one time I did a festival in Japan, our set shrunk by about 15 minutes because the song would end and there'd be applause, but then there'd just be all silence. And normally I'd have some chats and banter, but after like two gaps, it was like, just play the next song, Dan. This is and they were lovely, but it's just a different culture.
That's
different,
how they enjoy response. It. Yeah. And so there are quiet gigs in stand up where someone shouts something, and it can be anything, right? Yeah. Sometimes someone shouting your shit is a gift, because the answer to that is, I know I'm not having my best one, I can't work out what's going on. What's your name? Because you don't have to be scared of your shit, because it's either you are having a shit gig, and them saying it's like everyone knew it, including you, or the opposite, where you're not, and you're going, excuse me, I'm actually having one of the best gigs of my life here.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm not for you. And again, it's a door that you open, and not being scared of it, quite often it can just become this glorious thing. What's their name? And either they're really drunk, so they're not listening. So them saying that your shit isn't an insult. It's just that they think you should do it. Or if you're having a bad gig, that can save you.
Yeah,
because you can go into, did we get off on the wrong foot? What was it?
You get a reboot.
Yeah, and you get to go, was that too harsh? Should I not have opened telling you about my abortion? I used to open. And all of it then doesn't feel like you're set anymore. And so literally the thing you were stuck inside having to say, it's like it's now all chaos. And everyone relaxes and warms up. And it can be, it can be so great.
I mean, it's tough. Yeah. Because we're giving just really mixed messages, essentially. We're saying we shouldn't be censored, but then we kind of don't punch it out.
But this is why, and I might have said it when I was here last time, I've always thought this thing about, so the thing about not being censored, the audience aren't censored either.
Yeah.
So while I don't think it's great that people shout at James Acaster, the right to shout out in comedy where people don't shout in theatre is that it's not bourgeois.
Yeah.
And if you are not enjoying it, you can go to the bar, you can leave. You can, usually if it's a club gig, someone else will be on in 10 minutes, so it's great. But I actually like the fact that you're not so oppressed by the status of the person on stage, because we're supposed to be losers.
Yeah.
And so actually, if the loser is losing, point it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, when it's kind of a very drunk person, but quite sometimes people heckle you something that's so funny it gets a round of applause, and then everyone thinks it's magic. They don't think, oh, that wasn't actually the comedian's joke.
Yeah.
They just think they're having a nice time.
What a good night that was.
And also, if all heckling stopped, it would be like what you're saying in Japan.
Yeah.
It would be like, it's like the theatre now. It's a play. And so it is mixed messages.
Enjoy.
The Edinburgh Festival, you could go into 6 or 7 different shows in a day who all expected a different behaviour from their audience.
Yeah, but again, it all comes down to experience, right?
Yeah.
The more you're experienced of comedy, Stuart Lee used to have an amazing bit where no matter how well the gig was going, he'd always explain that they're not getting it quite right, but he can assure them it's good because he knows more about comedy than them, because he's been to far more gigs.
Yeah.
And it was always an amazing bit. The first time I saw it, I genuinely thought the show was falling apart.
Yes, that he's made it up.
And then it was like, oh no, this is a routine.
He's one of the prime ones, actually. I'm glad you mentioned him, about how he deals with people shouting out, because usually there's a version of that.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen him for a couple of years, but he used to have a thing. I saw him get heckled at Christmas by a Christmas party that they then left, and he didn't know that the person who'd shouted out, they'd gone somewhere like, right, so he didn't hear it.
Yeah.
But he at that point would sit down when someone heckled. So he'd kind of pull up a little stool and sit down and then ask them to repeat what they'd said. So he gave it this real weight of import.
Yeah.
And I imagine quite often they didn't shout out. In this instance, it's just because they'd left. And then he went into this monologue about how he's a really good comedian, been doing comedy for like decades, considered like the master of the craft, yet someone had seen clear, they'd seen a flaw in him somehow, they needed to shout out, and he couldn't go home to Christmas and his family because he'd be sitting there wondering
what
the audacity of him sometimes, how he does that.
Yeah.
His routine about Robin Williams killed himself because of unreliable audiences is sublime.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. Well, I'll start to wrap things up.
Yeah,
but before I do, there's two other things I definitely want to talk about, even if it's briefly.
Yeah,
I think one of the best shows and most under-shouted about shows of the last year or two is Frankie Boyle's New World Order.
Actually, when we were talking about it,
absolutely fantastic, and I thought you were a key part of that. And how was that to be part of?
I'm really lucky because I don't know Frankie Boyle very well.
Yeah.
I've always been a fan of him. Like we're talking about Jeselnik. Frankie Boyle jokes about stuff I don't go anywhere near.
Yeah.
Anywhere near. And that's just a choice of me as a comedian. It's a choice what I find interesting to write about. But his form And well, his
the
passion.
The monologues at the end of the show each time are a prime example.
His writing, and I think lots of people now through his journalism have come to Frankie, not through like Mock the Week days and stand up, but through his political opinion. And so I don't know him particularly well, but I guess. I mean, he got me the job. Originally, it was me and Catherine, but Catherine's become too busy to be this regular. So I get to watch him doing it every week. And what's really brilliant about it is that the BBC allow Frankie to pick the topics.
Great.
So there was a week where we had on, I can't remember her name, which is terrible, but she was absolutely brilliant. And basically, she was talking about the left-wing reasons for wanting to leave the EU.
Yeah.
And so when Frankie comes up with something like that, I feel like, oh, I'm so lucky, not only to get to be in the room and hear the unedited version, and I'd really recommend if anyone wanted to, it's only about 100 people at the hospital club in Covent Garden, but just to come and watch a show, because actually it's like a really interesting university lecture, because the experts he has on, he just lets them talk and talk and talk.
Yeah.
And with that, having a really, really, I found it so hearty to be talking about the left-wing reasons for wanting to leave the EU, because that's how lots of my friends felt before Brexit. And then those arguments have been completely shouted down, and they're a really important part of the argument for democracy.
Yeah.
And so this woman was outlaying it so perfectly, and it just felt so reasonable. It quite often feels very reasonable in the room.
Yeah.
And then I think they edit it down to a much shorter, funnier version.
Yeah.
But no, I feel very lucky to work with him.
That's great. And again, I just think the way he'll always have a genuine expert on. It won't just be his comedians giving their opinions.
And also the comedians he picks, because he's a big part of that process. And often the host of a show is the steerer, whether it's Dara or Mock the Week, or whether it's like Jimmy Carr with his shows. And Frankie, we've had a couple of very new comedians, either their first or maybe second TV appearance.
Yeah.
But Frankie's so interested in their worldview.
Yeah.
And there's nowhere else where anyone goes like, oh, yeah, let that person, let's do that because I think people should hear what they've got to say.
Or the excitement when I saw Doug Stanhope was on was like, wow, because I love Doug, but you don't really put Doug on TV. Charlie Brooker did a few times, but in general.
Yeah.
And part of that is half the time I'll hear him and go, no, you can't say, that's horrible.
Well,
you can't
I found him really difficult, with Doug Stanhope. And the reason is, number one, okay, this is hot goss, no one drinks before Frankie's show, so some TV shows, you know, they'll give you a glass of wine or ask what you want to drink when you're out there. There's nowhere to put a glass. And there's just been a universal decision that everyone has a drink after, so if you ever want to have a drink. Doug Stanhope, I think it's in his rider that he's hammered.
Yeah.
So it's the only time I've had a guest where they were being given drinks in between chats.
Yeah.
And I found him to be contrarian to the point of very unreasonable.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's because I would be like saying a joke. So you're kind of setting up your joke, or sometimes he'd just halfway through your sentence say, no, you're not making sense to me. I was talking about something about Tories and Labour, and it's like you're talking about star signs. It doesn't even mean anything. Like, what are you saying?
Yeah.
And no one else has been that disrespectful to me.
Having the one drunk person on the show, because Doug's a great example, because he's got that Jeselnik thing, but it might take half an hour to get to it. Like when I watch him live, you'll be like, this is really offensive. When it finally gets round to the point, it's amazing. But that's a show. That's not just an interacting appearance.
But this is the thing about comics in general, is I think we become very unbearable because at work it's only us talking.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. And I would say that's what's hard about Doug Stanhope, is he's a kind of alpha male.
Yeah.
Who just will talk and talk and talk and talk. And some of the men who do panel shows are like that. The majority of them aren't. They have to be team players.
Yeah.
Or they don't work.
Yeah.
There's a couple that are like that. And I realise I've now got a thing where I'm an alpha male.
Yeah.
And I react really badly to those men. And they react really badly to me. Because to them, basically, they say, I disagree with you. And I go, I disagree with you. And so it's not very conducive to...
Yeah. It's a fascinating one because, as said, I feel he is someone that if you let him talk and talk and talk, there'll be a payoff.
Mm.
But that, as said, that's not necessarily good for an interactive show, because it's like that means if you don't, all you're going to get is the bits where, man, that's a horrible thing to say, or that just sounds rude, that sounds offensive, because he's someone that needs that space, but that's not the right fit for... any kind of interaction with other humans.
No.
It's right for a stand-up. It's right for being on stage holding the microphone.
Course. Yeah, that, and that's the point. That's what you're there for. Yeah. I've realised as well with Doug Stanhope and a couple of other comics in that ilk, I'm not that interested in what they have to say. I do acknowledge the skill, but I guess I'm not his crowd particularly.
Yeah, I feel. That's exciting. Well, I mean, speaking of the kind of finding yourself to be an alpha male, it's exciting that you've got these shows that are yours now rather than you being part of. Mm-hmm. So we've talked a bit about a comedian's giving lectures, but you've also got a Last Woman on Earth on the BBC where you're doing a travel show, which is exciting because I thought I'd done a bit of research and I thought only male comedians could do travel shows, but it turns out
I've told them I'm a man.
Females can as well. Oh, that's it. You've decided you're an alpha. You're the alpha male.
That's it. I walked in there and went, guys. So I did a documentary last year, just a one-off, where a blind man who runs a travel company where blind people and sighted people go on holiday together.
Right,
So I did a documentary with him, and doing a documentary is not the holiday I expected it to be, annoyingly, but I did realise it's a really fascinating, because essentially it's like if you made a sitcom by overfilming it by 100 times and then decided what the story was.
Mm.
And so, and this one, we're going to Cuba and Georgia in August and September. So I'm so excited because I'm not a well-travelled person. And now I'm at a stage now, I'm watching other people's documentaries about those places and just trying to learn about them. But they're both hugely affected by the fall of the USSR in quite polar ways. And they're now going through a huge amount of change. Georgia, because it's kind of closing up, and Cuba, because it's opening up to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So I'm just so fascinated.
I love it.
Yeah. That's really great. Yeah.
Exciting. And do you kind of like that now? Because there's going to, I think with anything, there's always a fear. I don't know. I don't know if it's just me. Often it's more comfortable to be part of someone else's project, because the pressure isn't on you. Like if Frankie Boyle's New World Order fails, no one's going to be like, well, Sarah,
and actually you fucked that up. There's a terrible review of it.
Yeah,
it's like of Frankie.
Yeah,
and Frankie in his format. I don't. Do you know what it's interesting because I don't feel worried about the documentary, and also with comedians giving lectures, it's not my format.
Yeah.
So it's like I host it.
Yeah.
So if people don't watch it or don't like it, again, I don't feel like it wasn't my dream or my baby. With the documentary, I guess the worst thing that can happen really in TV is that no one watches it.
Yeah.
So that, and actually that isn't my fear. I'd go, then no one even knows. That's fine. I got paid. No one even knows.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's kind of lovely. Well, I'll wrap things up there. Where can people keep up to date with all that is ahead
going on? A website.
Excellent.
Yeah, and I guess on Instagram I post much more than Twitter nowadays, but I am on Twitter as well.
Yeah.
And
Mouse has got his own Instagram as well.
My boyfriend runs his Instagram. It's not me, in case you think. She said she was busy and she's just posting pictures of a dog all day. But he's a very photogenic dog. Yeah.
He really is. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to actually to
so
catch up.
To
and
you.
Now we're going to actually take the Polaroid photo and get it this time. Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go, guys. You know, started a podcast. I hyped this. I said I think it might be my favourite ever. Not one of my favourites, but my favourite ever. I hope you agree, because that was a hell of a conversation, and I'm really proud of it, and I'm really glad that we had it. If you enjoyed it as much as I did, please scream and shout about it. I've noticed a weird thing that I see a lot, and this is, you know, it's, I hope it's just chance, but this year I've since every time or most of the times I've seen posts and people screaming and shouting about particular episodes, it's been for the male guests. And again, I've had some amazing male guests, so it's probably just chance. I'm not putting anything on here or making it heavy. I mean, it's been for a lot of the white male guests. But yeah, shout about the variation on this podcast. I've had some really cool guests this year. I've had, over the whole length of the podcast, I've had some amazing guests. But in particular, I feel this is an episode that's worth shouting about and celebrating. I was really, I loved this. I can't wait for all of Sarah's projects, her book, multiple shows. I mean, we talk about all of it, as well as going off on all sorts of tangents. I feel that Sarah should be on every year. She should be a regular guest, because we don't need to talk about stuff that she's promoting. We can just talk about stuff that she's educated herself in and learned and is excited about and passionate about and angry about and worried about, you know? So, yeah, really pleased with this episode. Another thing I'm pleased with, I'll tell you now, is we've had the new edition of the Pod Bible out. We launched in London, Brighton, and up in Edinburgh at the Fringe. Pod Bible is a magazine that you can get new podcast recommendations from, essentially. We're also about to launch, so on Monday, we're launching the Pod Bible podcast. Please go and have a listen to the trailer. The idea, I'm going to be putting out a special bonus episode talking to Stu and Adam of Pod Bible. And yeah, the idea of it is that it's 20 to 30 minutes. It's a little mini episode every week. The way I describe it is it's a supplement, not a meal replacement for your regular podcast diet. So you can enjoy it alongside all your regulars rather than feel it has to replace someone. I always find if I'm traveling, I'll often have a podcast finish a little bit before the end of my journey. And I'll be at the end of my journey, so I won't necessarily want to start a new episode of something, particularly if it's big or deep. But I don't want to sit with my own thoughts. Are you crazy? So yeah, that's kind of where the Pod Bible slips in. We can be there if it's on iTunes, Spotify and Acast. If you like and subscribe, an automatic download. It's only short, so it won't take up tons of space in your phone, and you can just have it there. As said, to call upon in emergencies. So yeah, that's the Pod Bible podcast, and Pod Bible magazine is at podbiblemag.com. So go and check all of that out. Is there anything else I need to tell you about? I don't think so. I guess I could mention next week's guest. You know, sometimes I do this thing where I get Buddy to cut it and put it in the beginning. I'm not even going to do that this time, because next week's guest is someone you lot have been waiting for ages. And it's another one. It's one of my favourites. Straight off the bat, it's a really important and deep and open and interesting conversation. But I'm not even going to get him to put this at the beginning, because I want this for just the people who've stuck around. I mean, the people in the Patreon crew already know. But just for the people who've stuck around till the end, my Team 3WGs, because you're going to be excited about this, because you've been requesting it for ages. Next week, I sit down with Joe Gilgan of This Is England, of Preacher, of his new series Brassic, which is fantastic. Yeah, I've been trying to line this up for ages. I'm so pleased we had this conversation. It really gets deep with stuff that's really personal to me and stuff that's really personal to Joe. Joe is so open and honest in it. It's amazing. Yeah, that's next week. How's that for a guest? I'm buzzing for that one, man. It's going to be so good. He's only been on one podcast in the past, and it's the Two Shot podcast. It's a fantastic podcast. He's done two episodes on there. They're both amazing. I'm really proud of what we got as well. I feel honoured and privileged to join Two Shot in the limited documentation of the wonderful Mr. Joseph Gilgan. Woody from This Is England, Cassidy from Preacher, and Vinny in his new series Brassic. But it's a brilliant character. You're going to adore him. So yeah, that's next week. You might want to get in on that one and listen and enjoy. This week I'll be recording a few new ones as well, so if you are on the Patreon crew for just a dollar, you can see who I've been chatting with. Yeah, that's pretty good, isn't it? I'm pretty pleased with that. Yeah, I'll see you all next week, guys. Until then, ta-ta.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.